touching the ground, I connect with all of life. Touching my heart, I awaken compassion for all life. You are listening to Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey, a podcast about life, the variety of lived spiritualities of the people around us, and how we are much more alike than different. I am your host, Brother Pax. Hi friends, it is your favorite ginger-haired host, Pax. When people explore other religions, one of the things that often pops up is a feeling of inauthenticity, especially when we're looking at religions from other cultures. And how do we overcome that, or how do we find something that is authentically ours? As one who has explored many different spiritual paths, I know that feeling. And today, my guest, Ben Stimson, is going to talk a little bit about spiritual authenticity and his latest book. So give it up for Ben Stimson. Ben, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It is a great pleasure to have you.
Absolutely. It's good to see you again, Jay.
It was great to see you. So for the listeners, talk about what was your growing up like? Where did you grow up, and what kind of kid were you?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's actually a very large part of my kind of life story, to be honest. So originally, I'm from the UK. I'm from North Wales, which is kind of the area just kind of west of Liverpool, Manchester, and that whole stretch of coast. I'm not a Welsh speaker myself. My parents moved to Wales, but I also have Welsh background too. So a lot of my kind of background story is kind of really being in the liminal spaces. So when I was born, normal kid, happy kid, living in the middle of nowhere, and then they discovered that I have something called dyspraxia, which is a developmental disorder affecting motor control. And so I wasn't able to learn how to speak properly and communicate. And so my parents got onto the school board, and they connected me with speech therapists, and I learned how to speak. That's actually where my accent comes from, because my accent partially comes from my parents, but also partially comes from the Welsh woman who was my speech therapist. And so I was a very happy, blonde, blue-eyed little kid with, you know, little spindly little legs, and I was just happy. And then my parents decided to move to Canada, and that changed. So a big part of my life and kind of the kid I grew into was the trauma of moving. And the trauma of moving away, not only from my friends and my family, my whole extended families in the UK, but also away from my home, my homeland.
About how old were you when that happened?
I was 8 and a half when that happened. Okay. So I was old enough that I could still remember a great deal of my life in the UK.
Right.
But I was young enough that I couldn't really understand what was happening. Like, I knew we were moving, and I knew that we were moving to a whole different country. We'd visited Canada on holiday a couple of times beforehand, but I don't think anybody really anticipated what the effect of that would be for me. And so the effect was, I moved from a place where my whole life, despite having a developmental disorder, my life was just normalized. I was just me, right? I had my friends. It was like these people I'd grown up with. We were kids together, right? And then suddenly I was different. I was British. I spoke differently. I was foreign. I was an immigrant. And then that kind of, those differences kind of just kept on going as I grew up. So I became a very unhappy kid. I became a kid who was deeply, I don't want to say troubled, but it created a lot of issues around control for me, because I didn't get a chance to have a say of moving, right? And my parents, like, to be fair, my parents, they never like intended to create issues for me. There's no way of really gauging how such a huge, massive upset as moving, even if it's voluntary immigration, will have on a child. But for me, unfortunately, it created a lot of weird control issues for me. Feeling of lack of control. And so I was bullied a lot when I was a kid. I wasn't happy. And I really pined for home. I really pined for anything to do with the United Kingdom. British sitcoms, Absolutely Fabulous was one of my absolute favorites. Oh, yes. I used to watch it when I was a kid. And I think that had a lot to do with my latest psychosexual developments. So, but yeah, I grew to be a very unhappy kid, and I grew to be a very unhappy teenager. And then, and as I said, like, you know, those differences continued to take place. And I started to understand that I was gay when I was about 10, 11. Finally came out when I was about 14. I started exploring witchcraft and paganism, mainly because I really wanted to connect with the UK and back home, and that sense of like British feeling, right? And that came from actually watching The Mists of Avalon when that came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. So, you know, suddenly I had this image of this wonderful, you know, Arthurian landscape where there was a goddess who was all loving versus, you know, the Christian god who hated me, you know.
No, it is not the best acting in the movie, but
it was not the best,
love it. I still love it. I think partly because of the music and just the feeling, the book, same way. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I put two and two together really from that. I think it really hit me. There's a scene where Morgaine is on the lake's shore, mm-hmm. and it's all misty, and she's calling out, and there's no response. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that, like, when I was a kid, you know, I would often like just have dreams where I was flying home, you know, flying back to the UK, or I was in the UK, mm-hmm. right? And that was a home that was
just cross those mists and you'd be back.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Wow. So that's who I was when I was a kid. I went from a very, very happy youngster to somebody who was abused. And unfortunately what that happened was I, as a way of trying to gain control in my life, I would lash out to the people closest to me. So, you know, like my little brother, my sister, my parents. I would just become really stubborn, and I, you know, I had this weird sense about that I was better than everyone around me, and I tried to act that way, and like, you know, like little 13-year-old, you know, like, you know, it was not great. I just made a face, and I was just, it was not great. So that's the type of person I was back then, mm-hmm. and a lot of my work now has been to kind of give that kid who I was the love that he really needed.
Now, do you consider yourself, would you describe yourself as pagan? And if so, what type would you consider?
That's a good choice. Yeah, good. I'm moving, the more I move into my practice, the more I kind of evaluate where I've come from. I don't know if I would take the name pagan. I love the community. I love the pagan community. Yeah. But I my practice is so personal now that I define myself based on those spiritual relationships. So I've been very lucky to have been connected with Lukumi Santeria, with paganism, with Druidry, with all sorts of the Hinduism. Advaita Hinduism was a big thing for me, and still is. So I really define myself, I guess, based on kind of who I'm interacting with and what I'm engaging with in my life.
Almost like a chameleon, or not in a bad way.
I was going to say.
Yeah, no, and I guess I'm identifying very much with that because, again, the past probably year or so, I've a lot less defined myself by things like that. And it really depends on the community I'm with. I am perfectly adaptable. Even my image of the divine mm-hmm. can adapt depending on who I'm having a conversation with and who I'm connecting with or the community. And I'm okay with that.
And I think coming to that place of being okay with that, I think for a long time for me, you know, the identity of I am pagan mm-hmm. was really a reaction to some of the things I was dealing with in my life.
Right.
And so for me to be able to assert my control over how I was identifying myself mm-hmm. was a way of me then asserting my control over things that really I didn't have control over.
Right.
And so now I'm in a place in my life where I'm in a lot more of acceptance of what I'm not able to control and the limits of that, you know, I'm not as interested in, you know, walking and in defining myself based on other people's standards. Because as soon as you say pagan, well, you have all sorts of different people in the room that identify pagan in different ways. They're creating a sense of who you are based on that single word. I'm not about that. I'm not looking to give my power over that way. And right. So if people, you know, I can define myself based on where I am. And not so much in a chameleon sense, but I understood what you were saying with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So shifting gears slightly then, what does your daily practice look like? Do you have a daily practice, regular practice?
I do. It's kind of up in upheaval right now because I'm kind of in moving mode, and I just moved back in with my parents because I'm planning on moving back to the UK next year. But generally my daily practice, if I were to look at it bare bones, I start every single day by saying embrace the day. And that's something I've been doing for at least the past 10 years now. So before I even get out of bed, I'll say to my cat, who's deaf and is sitting next to me and looking at me and not hearing me at all, I'll say, embrace the day, Sky, embrace the day. And that's my way of welcoming the day. And then something I've actually been doing since I started, since I was in university or college, I should say, back in 2005, I started originally because I moved out of my parents' house for the first time. I was living on my own in residence for the first time. And there was I can't remember exactly when it was, but I remember just like sitting there, I think it was the first or second week, looking up at the light on the ceiling in the dark room. And I thought to myself, well, here we are. And then it was here we are again. And so every night I take that moment to think about that cycle of time for myself. And I say to myself, here we are again, here we are again. So bare basics, I start with a embracing of the day, and then I end with the understanding of that cyclical path. Depending upon kind of the season, depending upon what's going on in my life, my daily practice shifts and changes. During the summertime, I made it a concerted effort to go for a walk every single day. And that was partly because of my fitness journey. I know you follow me on Facebook, so you were seeing. But I also took that chance to connect with nature because the trail I was walking on was beautiful. And it was an hour and 20 minutes of just being with myself. Occasionally I would listen to music. Most of the time I was just, you know, taking my mala and I was just reciting or chanting, or I was just being in the world, right? And so that's a huge part of my daily practice now, is just being more mindful and being present in whatever way that shapes up.
Right. Are there any books that have been strongly influential in your spirituality? You're a reader. You're a reader like I am. So good luck. Here we go.
I have to think about that for a second. There's been many. Yeah. I've been, in truth, because of writing my own book, and we'll talk about that soon, I've been trying to actually wean myself off of a dependency on books, mainly because for me, a lot of my work is relationship. But I would say that one of the most important ones in the past few years has actually not been a pagan book at all. It's been something really out there, but it really infused my way of relating to spirit and spirituality and spirits and the landscape. And there's an anthropologist down in Australia named Dr. Lynn Kelly. And she came out with several books based on memory systems. And what she, her background is kind of all over the place, but she started researching, started looking at the relationship between kind of sacred sites like Stonehenge, or like, I always butcher it, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. Which is an ancient, like it's almost 8,000 years old. It's one of the first structures that we have, humans developed. And what she suggested was that these ancient sites were actually physical representations of much larger landscapes. So as people were in various different parts of the world, were transitioning from a hunter-gatherer society to a landed agrarian society, they had to find a way to change their oral memory systems that they had been using Which if you look at like Australian, she's from Australia, she's connected with the Australian Aboriginal people down there. When you look at the spiritual traditions of the Australians, they place their stories, mythology, and their way of life and their laws and their entire corpus of their lifestyle into the landscape. And so when they walk their landscape, they're able to like pick up and retrace information systems, but they're all in memory, right? They don't have any written language. And so what Dr. Lynn Kelly was saying was, when people would transition from having access to much larger landscapes where, like modern folklore, you know, stories and information and data and historical information was connected to specific sacred sites through the method of Loki, they needed to have a localized, smaller kind of subsystem of that so that they could still go and perform their rituals that would allow them to revisit that information. And it was amazing. I mean, there's no way of proving this, but it certainly makes sense. And she went through a lot of the kind of the oral traditions around the world and how memory systems are often connected to spiritual ritual and also you know, like folk traditions, as a way of maintaining memory systems and like oral culture. And that really affected and impacted kind of my approach to the landscape around me and also like the just the rituals of life, right? And so that was really impactful. I can't think, I mean, it's also unfair because I know so many authors, I could say all of their books were influential on me, but that would be unfair too. So yeah. And if that answers your question.
Well, so talking about books, you have a book coming out. Talk a little bit about
it. Yeah, so I the book is called Ancestral Whispers. I started it during the pandemic, but I also started the core of it about a year before. So in 2019, I started, I finished my psychotherapy training, and I was looking at creating new ways of offerings, workshops, whatnot, for clients. And so I sat down, and ancestor work has been a huge part of my life in the past 5 years, and really a huge part of my life since I came from the UK, actually, being disconnected from my ancestors over there physically and also just like culturally. They were always there, but I didn't really connect with them in a landed way. So I started writing this course. It was an eight-week course called Ancestral Whispers back in 2019. And then the pandemic hit, and I suddenly had nothing. No, all my clients disappeared because we couldn't afford therapy at that time. The government was giving us money to support ourselves. So I moved into my apartment down in Kitchener, kind of was trying to live by myself for a while. And I thought, well, you know what? I have this bulk of information, this mass of data, and I think this could be a good book. I think that right now this is a very topical thing. A lot of people are interested in ancestral work, and especially people who are not connected with kind of traditions which have those ancestral rituals and practices already as part of them. Let's be honest, a lot of white Western people who are disconnected from both the kind of the homelands in Europe, but also from spiritual traditions that have a heavy emphasis on ancestral work. And so what's happening is a lot of people are connecting with or being inspired by Native American and especially Dia de los Muertos down in Mexico, the Day of the Dead. And so I thought, okay, well, if I was writing a book, if I was interested in ancestral work and I didn't have the benefit of the spiritual traditions I had been part of all this time, what kind of book would I want to write? What would I want for me, right? So I wrote a book. And what I love is that it isn't a book that is going to give you a tradition. My job in the book is not to give you rituals or practices or spells or prayers or a way of connecting with your ancestors. My book is, in some ways, it's more of a like a coaching session. I'm giving you the resources. I'm giving you the the examples from around the world of what ancestor traditions have looked like, and then begging the question then, okay, how does what you're reading here relate to your relationship with your ancestors already?
So you're using the Socratic method.
I am, yes.
You are, yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. You know, I'm laying down. So a lot of the book is examples from all over the world. I try to find a pretty good balance between representing the various different strains of thought. I start out in chapter one by exploring kind of the nature of personhood, because really, how can you work with dead people if you don't understand for yourself what that means? What is a person? First, and secondly, what makes them dead? You know, what is the difference between someone who's alive and someone who's dead? Because in the Western world, we often, because of Judeo-Christianity, and we tend to see them as being off in the middle of nowhere, you know, removed from this world, inaccessible, we're not going to be connecting with them. And yet, the majority of the world's traditions, the dead are in the home, the dead have a shrine, the dead have connection with the world, and they are able to impact the world. And so you better be prepared to make offerings to them in order to appease great grandma, because if she gets pissed off, she's gonna cause a ruckus, right? But also that connection with that idea of serving one's ancestors in the same way that your descendants are going to serve you when you're an ancestor, right? That idea strongly of ancestors in waiting, right? So essentially, that's what I did. I wrote the first half of the book is kind of exploring the way the ancestor tradition and relationships exist around the world, and then all of the questions around, well, how does this connect to your history? How does this connect to your relationship? And what does your relationship, how is your relationship informed based on how your beliefs are? Because I also talk about that idea of people who don't belong to traditions of their ancestors, Christians, right? A lot of neo-pagans are going to be reading this book, a lot of people more connected with the New Age who have either rejected Christianity because of religious trauma, or they grew up in a secular household and they're refinding spirituality for themselves, and so they're not really necessarily connected to those older forms of tradition, right? So I address that as well. So in the first half, it's exploring the kind of the thinky bits, thinking about and conceptualizing. In the second half, we move into the ins and outs of ritual practice.
Now, before you get into that, so
of course, yes,
toss out a couple of questions that come to mind as you're talking about it. Because, so I'm kind of, it's very funny. I'm an agnostic on the afterlife, as far as I really don't know. Mm-hmm. Coming way back from a fundamentalist background, I think I was one of those people that still pictured them out there that might occasionally visit, even from a Catholic view, the saints might come for a visit, but they reside in heaven or wherever. Mm-hmm. And then played around with the idea of reincarnation as I was exposed to Hinduism and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And it was always interesting, because then that threw a loop as far as talking to them, because what if they were reincarnated and then what? But I've not really considered that logical fact. And I guess I've kind of known that they may reside in the shrine or in the home. Mm-hmm. And I could just picture grandma, don't make it a ruckus, or grandma, calm it down. Well, I'll bring you some coffee here.
That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. I think a lot of my readers, because I assume that a lot of my readers are going to have a very similar approach as me because of my background and kind of how I grew up in the pagan community and I grew up in spiritual communities. I see a lot of people who have kind of hands in multiple pies. They're influenced by multiple traditions. We're no longer in the Western world, only one strict tradition, at least in the spiritual communities we're a part of. And so, questions of, okay, well, what do you actually believe? Really test out and understand and explore that for yourself. With the whole idea of reincarnation, right? If you believe simultaneously that reincarnation is a possibility and also that there's an afterlife, well, how do you conceptualize that? How do you navigate between those two poles? Is there necessarily a binary in those? can there be a continuum of existence in the pagan community, for example? You know, there's often the idea that there are multiple parts of a soul. So one part of a soul is reincarnated, and then a personality is residing in an afterlife.
That's Hinduism. Yeah.
That's Hinduism, exactly, well, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, you know. Yeah. And I mean, well, I love Hinduism too, with the Pitripaksha, with the whole idea that, you know, in that 1 month where they're kicked out of Indra's heaven and they kind of just around the house, and so you have to make sure that you're appeasing them, because, you know, love that.
Checking things out.
Yeah.
So in thinking about, you know, honoring your ancestors or keeping a shrine for them in the home, mm-hmm. what about those who harmed us in life?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I do talk about that in the book too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It comes back to how you conceptualize the ancestors, right? There are both traditions which will say that, you know, the individuals who are harmful to us in life will be subsumed into an afterlife where they're purified. There's also those perspectives where they will have need to be elevated and given light, and so that they're not going to then continue to harm people from the other side. And I've seen both in my own personal kind of practice. And right. You know, I used to work psychic fairs back in the day, and you could see that there were people from the other side who were impacting people in our life right now, mm-hmm. In very negative ways. I think that again comes back to, and the central point of the book is relationship. You get to define your relationship with individuals, but you also get to define your relationship with groups, right? And so if you approach work with the ancestors as a collective, as a group, as a family unit, as a whole group of ancestors, then when honoring, do you necessarily need to necessarily honor individuals who hurt you, right? But I think also that's where the responsibility piece comes in too, and that's where relationship comes in, is then understanding how, and I talk about like family systems and structures, how then you are responsible in this life not to perpetuate the pain that those individuals caused you. And that's a touchy subject. I actually had, when I was doing one of these classes, one of the individuals had a hard time working with that for themselves, not because they didn't want to be responsible, but because they had been made responsible for things that weren't their responsibility in life by these people who had hurt them. And so the thought of having to take responsibility for doing that extra work to not perpetuate harm to other generations was act and triggering, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So does that answer your question?
Somewhat. I'm going to ask it maybe a little bit more. Imagine a young lady, and she had a father or an uncle or a grandfather whom sexually abused her.
Yes.
I mean, it's perfectly. And again, I think I already know your answer, but she may not want any pictures of this father on the shrine. She may have mothers, sisters, grandmothers, but not this person. And almost in a place of boundaries, wouldn't it be, you know what, I wish for you to grow and develop and heal, but you're not welcome here. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, you said you thought you knew what my answer was. What do you think I would say?
Well, I don't know. Now that I say that, you know, I thought maybe you would say something like that, possibly. But I don't know. Yeah, so that's why I ask.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's one of those, I touch in the book about, again, taking responsibility for building the type of relationship that you're comfortable with in the book, mm-hmm. right? Because at the end of the day, there's this beautiful concept called the mantle of life. We are holding the mantle of life as living beings. We get to decide what our relationships are to the people in the afterlife, right? In the same way that when we're dead, our descendants will get to decide how they relate to us, right?
Yeah.
And I think that it really depends on kind of where the person is at and what they're comfortable with. And this is where I disagree with some writers on ancestors, that see the ancestors as a great chain of being. You have to work through one in order to get to the others. In my opinion, you know, if you are so uncomfortable with working with somebody who hurt you, then go to their ancestors, go to their elders, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also would say, and I talk about this as well, in what way are you harming yourself by not working on that trauma for yourself? And that is going to sound horrible, but I'm going to clarify a bit here.
Thank you, because you knew where I was going, probably.
Yes. So I work as a therapist. That's a huge part of my work. And I have noticed that when it comes to trauma, and when it comes to living with the after effects of being harmed in such a way like that, it is often ourselves that we traumatize ourselves. And the difficulty with when somebody who has harmed us in that way dies, is that often there's no way of gaining closure, there's no way of gaining justice, there's no way of, because of our Christian, right, like Judeo-Christian culture, which says, well they're now inaccessible, they're off somewhere else.
Right.
And so then we're left to pick up pieces. And part of that work, I think, for us is, again, understanding, you know, what are our boundaries? How are we comfortable, and what is our practice going to be around that? And that's what I was saying before, moving into kind of the building a living practice. I believe strongly that living practice has to be informed by belief. It has to be informed by a solid understanding of how we're conceptualizing ancestors and working with ancestors. And if it is too painful for you to work with an ancestor that has harmed you, then don't work with them. You know, don't work with them. Yeah. But the responsibility is then to do the inner work and find that healing for yourself. Sometimes that healing can be going to the ancestors above, going to those healthy ancestors, in the hopes then that you can gain that support that you didn't have from that individual when they were alive. But I think the other crucial piece there is, and this is also a very controversial word, forgiveness. Now, forgiveness is often taken up as condoning behavior, but I've always conceptualized forgiveness as moving on, being able to move on. And oftentimes when somebody has harmed us, it in some ways suits us to continue to see them as being the villain, as being stuck in that place of when they hurt you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And forgiveness, I think, is releasing both of you to be able to move on, so that you're no longer engaged in that relationship with that person. You know, I hope that is clearer, and I hope I was able to get across what I was saying with that. Absolutely. I do address that in the book, Will.
Yeah. All right. And then before I interrupted you earlier, you're about to talk about the second part of the book.
So the second part of the book really is about kind of putting into practice what you've thought about, what you've conceptualized in building a relationship with ancestors. You know, what does it look like to actually work with them? And for me, I think this is a strong point. You know, going back to your question about lived practice, you know, people can sit around and think about spirituality all day, but if you're not actually putting it into practice, then what's the point, right? You know, I mean, even monks who sit around all day thinking about these things actually go to cloister, actually go to matins, actually go and do the prayers, and put that into practice, right? And so I have noticed that a lot of people, the biggest question that they ask when it comes to ancestor work specifically is, what do I do? What can I do? Because they have images in their head of what ancestor work looks like. They're looking at the movie Coco. They're seeing, you know, ofrendas from Dia de los Muertos. In the pagan community, it's looking at and emulating specific groups of ancestors from, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, right? That is ancestor work. To me, ancestor work can be anything, but oftentimes the way and the power of ritual and the power of prayer and the power of kind of the outward showings of practice is about communication. Right. And so I talk a great deal in the second half of the book around spiritual practice as a form of relationship and a form of communication. So when you're saying, and I'm not talking about just saying a specific prayer as like, you know, verbal communication, but the use of symbols as a communicating point to, you know, spiritual beings. You know, what does color represent both to you in a space, but also to those unseen forces? When you put food down in a particular place, in a particular way, what is that communicating about, first of all, what you're believing, but also how you're interacting with unseen forces? So many pieces. So what I do is, each chapter of the second half is devoted to a particular part of a ritual practice, prayer, the use of space, creating altar space, or engaging in creating sacred space, pilgrimage, the idea of how are you relating to pilgrimage, what can you do on pilgrimage, the use of color in your practice, what is the use of color, use of offerings, what is offerings, how are you using offerings? What how does offering then connect with, and what does it say to your ancestors, you know? For example, so in Lukumi, when I was involved with the Lukumi is the proper word for Santeria, the Afro-Cuban tradition working with Eurasias. So being a tradition that has been heavily influenced by the slave trade and that experience in the Middle Passage, a lot of the work with ancestors is a nod to and symbolic of that trauma. And so in the traditional Lukumi offering bowl that we offer to ancestors, you know, specific pieces and offerings like molasses and water or coffee or, you know, white wine, all of those pieces are connected some way to appealing to the ancestors of the tradition that experienced that. That trauma. And we always put it down on the floor, and we always place it within a specific space in the house or outside. And all of that is devoted and to particular ancestors, but also the ancestors of whoever happens to be there. And also it communicates specific things. All of that is informed by belief. So I talk about that too, ritual practice informed by belief. If you see the ancestors as living up in heaven, or living up in the sky, why would you put your offerings down on the ground? Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't you want to put them up high? Same with if you believe that death is intrinsically, like many Asian cultures do, is intrinsically polluting, why would you put your ancestor's space right next to your kitchen, which is the symbol of life in the house, right? You know, so building a practice that is not only going to be referencing your beliefs and also informed by beliefs, but also connecting with your ancestors and what they believed. Yeah. So I talk about that as well, you know, incorporating elements that are special and specific to them, even if they don't necessarily tie in a religious way to you. But it's that way of, okay, you know, putting out a rosary that belonged to great Aunt Florence, for example, because she was a heavy Catholic, and that's how she believed. And that's then for her, not for you. That's right. A shared space for your ancestors. So that's kind of the way, the flow of the book. Yeah.
So what does your ancestor practice look like, if you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah, for sure. My ancestor practice has been heavily influenced by Lukumi. A lot of the elements that I use currently connect in with that tradition. I am changing it so that it's more related to my own mm-hmm. background. In preparation for moving home, moving back to the UK, I am starting to involve more and more practices that would have been relevant to my own ancestors. My ancestry over there is kind of all over the place. I literally Irish, Scottish, Welsh, English, and Cornish, and all of them somehow met 150 years ago in the middle somewhere. So
yeah. That's funny. Yeah, mine.
Same with you.
Mine. Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah. It's kind of a wild thing because, you know, so some of the other pieces there is to understanding then that shared history, you know, even though like 150 years ago, the ancestors seemed to be getting along, 50 years, 200 years before then, they would have been killing each other, right? So understanding kind of being sensitive to that history. Right. So I often will give a little bit of the food that I eat to my ancestors. I started a few years ago actually including pictures, and a project that I'm currently working on is actually creating a little small deck of cards which have individual pictures of all of my important ancestors. And genealogical research, huge part of my work too. So that's part of it. But also understanding then, and that's where kind of extending into the family stuff, understanding then, okay, well, what was I handed in my family, and what sort of stuff has come down the generations to me. So part of my work is not just in a spiritual practice sense, but it's also in an emotional and sure. intellectual sense. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, this is fascinating. So if one of the listeners wanted to learn more or reach out to you, how would they do that?
So I have an official website now, which is cool. So it's benstimson.com. Everything can be found on there. I am on Instagram. I do have a Facebook page as well. The book Ancestral Whispers is up for pre-order through Llewellyn. And I've had some amazing responses from fellow authors. And I just actually got a huge one from Daniel Forrest, who is a Celtic studies major over in the UK. And she gave a really good rundown of what the book's about. So I highly recommend that. And people can reach out through my website if you're interested.
Great. Well, Ben, thank you so much for being on here tonight. This has been
Absolutely.
Great.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been another episode of Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey. Thank you for walking with me as we spent time exploring the varieties of religious and spiritual expressions out there. Won't you consider joining our Patreon? Get sneak peeks of what is to come, early previews, and soon to have some video footage from the interviews, as well as polls on what you would like to see covered in future episodes. Join our Patreon today. The link is in the show notes.